Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, 4 days and counting, the Democrats in New Hampshire get a little bounce from a rather civil debate last night. We'll have reports from the Granite State.
Candidate Dean goes on a media offensive to undo damage from his war whoop and gets a little dig from Al Sharpton.
Governor Dean, don't be hard on yourself about hooting and hollering. If I had spent the money you did and got 18%, I'd still be in Iowa hooting and hollering.
Also, spirits rise at NASA as the Mars rover Spirit sputters back to life.
These stories and chaos theory and the butterfly effect, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Texas Oil Services and defense contracting giant Halliburton has reported to the Pentagon that a subcontractor in Iraq got a $6 million kickback from a Kuwaiti company supplying U.S. troops. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Halliburton acknowledged in a statement on its website that the company's internal auditors uncovered what it calls potential overbilling of $6 million to the U.S. government for its work in Iraq. It didn't specify the name of the Kuwaiti company or what the services were. The Wall Street Journal first reported the kickback today, adding that the Halliburton subsidiary, KBR, has fired two of its employees stationed in Kuwait. The Inspector General of the Defense Department and the General Accounting Office are conducting investigations into Halliburton's management of its multi-billion-dollar contract in Iraq to support U.S. troops. Halliburton says if the kickbacks are proven, it will reimburse the government and refer the case to the authorities. The Houston-based company has already come under criticism for overcharging the government for gasoline purchases in Kuwait. Halliburton denies charges of price gouging. John Burnett, NPR News, Washington.
Officials say four Marines were killed in last night's military helicopter crash north of San Diego. The cargo helicopter was on a night training mission at Camp Pendleton when it crashed. Another Huey helicopter crashed 2 years ago near the California-Arizona border. NASA has finally reestablished contact with the Spirit rover on Mars, though team members still aren't sure what condition the rover is in. Spirit had not sent back any data for 2 days. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
The communication session, initially reported as lasting 10 minutes, lasted 20 minutes. NASA sent a command, and the rover responded, sending back what the Jet Propulsion Lab called limited data. NASA will want to ask the rover for more information to try to diagnose its strange behavior over the last 2 days. In one transmission, Spirit sent only random ones and zeros. Other times, it didn't respond at all. Team members say the rover could be having a software problem. They could fix that by transmitting new commands. A hardware problem, however, could be catastrophic. The thinking has been that the rover is in what is known as a safe mode, where it knows there is a problem and sits waiting for instructions. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
With the final debate before Tuesday's New Hampshire primary behind them, Democratic presidential candidates are trying to convince voters they are electable. Howard Dean continued attacks on his rivals, saying it will take more than what he calls a Washington insider to defeat President Bush. Democrats in last night's debate were more polite to one another than in previous matchups. They saved most of their criticism for President Bush on issues ranging from tax cuts to the environment to his handling of post-war Iraq. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 25 points at 10,598. In active trading, the Nasdaq Composite is up 8 points at 2127. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, in New York, jury selection continues in the trial of Martha Stewart and her former stockbroker, Peter Baranovich. Prosecutors say they are worried about whether Stewart's fame will make it harder to seat an impartial jury. From member station WNYC, Kerry Nolan reports.
In a transcript released yesterday, prosecutors asked federal judge Miriam Goldman Cederbaum to specifically ask potential jurors whether their feelings about Stewart would impact their ability to be impartial. The lead prosecutor in the case raised the point after an episode Tuesday in which a woman was excused from jury service, then looked across the room at Stewart and said, "I'm a huge fan of yours. Good luck." Stewart's attorney twice told the judge he's worried jurors might mistakenly believe Stewart is charged with insider trading. She's accused of lying to investigators and misleading investors in her own company about why she sold nearly 4,000 shares of ImClone Systems stock in 2001, just before it plummeted on a negative government review of a company-developed drug. Lawyers for both sides say they hope to clear 50 potential jurors today and winnow those down to 12 by next week. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan.
The World Trade Organization has agreed to investigate a South Korean complaint that U.S. and European tariffs on some of its computer chip exports are illegal. The U.S. imposed a 44% duty on imports of dynamic access memory chips, or DRAM, from Hynix Semiconductor, saying the company was getting subsidies from the South Korean government. The European Union took similar action. Schlumberger, the world's number one oil field services company, today reported a higher-than-expected fourth-quarter profit. The company says the profit comes on increased oil and gas drilling. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The seven Democrats running for president last night held a civil debate in New Hampshire. Joining us on the line to talk about it is John Greenberg, executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio. John, welcome.
How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us. John, here's Howard Dean last night, serious, on message on many issues, here on Iraq.
Someone earlier made a remark about losing 500 soldiers and 2,200 wounded. Those soldiers were sent there by the vote of Senator Lieberman, Senator Kerry, and Senator Edwards. That is a fact, and I think that's a very serious matter.
Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean measured subdued last night, sticking to his guns on issues. Your thoughts, John?
Well, all of the candidates, pretty much all of them, did a pretty good job last night. And what Dean needed to do for himself is essentially he had to stop the hemorrhaging of his support. He needed to rehabilitate himself. Judging from the conversations that I had with undecided voters afterwards, he did that. I won't necessarily say that he won a lot of support, but I think he has successfully stopped the loss of support.
Yeah, he referred to that famous howl in his concession speech in Iowa, saying
exactly.
He's not a perfect person and it's okay for people to have fun at his expense, as they've been doing, he said. But did he settle his core voters down but not win any new voters?
Well, it's too uncertain for all of us to say whether or not he won any new voters. I feel relatively certain, having looked at some pretty detailed polling, to think that he probably settled down some of his people. I heard from one woman this morning who he may have actually won back. So I think that there's definitely a plus for Dean, because you got to remember his support was so strong in New Hampshire that all he had to do was hold on to a fair chunk of his previous support, and he's going to come out looking okay.
John, here's the man said to be the front runner by polls now, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, also on Iraq and President Bush's policy there.
Thank you very much.
There's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. He chose the wrong way. And he's run the most arrogant, inept, reckless, and ideological foreign policy in the modern history of our country.
Senator Lieberman, you...
Senator Kerry, John, has said repeatedly, like many a pundit, that he's the electability candidate. Did he project that aura last night effectively?
Kerry is another guy who helped himself last night. What he mainly needed to do, I think, or put it this way, from the people I spoke to, this is what they think, he needed to show some zip. And for most of them, not all of them, but for most of them, he did. And it was sort of they were seeing a Kerry that they wish they had seen before Iowa, but they're glad that they're seeing it now. You know, this whole electability issue hangs like a cloud over all of these candidates. And I can tell you this, that they all did well enough last night that the results for, among the voters is, if anything, they're more undecided than before. I heard a couple of them say, I wish I could just roll all of these guys up into a single candidate because they all have qualities that I think would work in November.
Well, one of those guys, General Wesley Clark, will be speaking to later in the program. Just in general, how do you think he did last night?
Clark is probably the guy who did himself the least favors last night. Remember, I'm here in New Hampshire, and I'm talking to people in New Hampshire who have seen Clark. And what they saw was a guy who stumbled around on some answers, but in general did okay, except that he was very subdued. He was a lot more subdued than when they have actually seen him in person. So I've got to say, what we've been seeing is that Clark has not been really rising very much in the polls. I don't think that this performance last night would make that much of a difference.
Just very briefly, Senators John Edwards and Senator Joseph Lieberman, how'd they make out?
Edwards, still, there are a lot of people who don't know him very well. He did a very good job of sort of saying, here's who I am, and he did it in a way that was clear and in a way that was convincing. Lieberman surprised a lot of the people that I talked to last night, the undecided voters. They hadn't given much thought to Lieberman, and they really liked the kind of sense of principle and not backing down from his position on Iraq. I don't know if that wins him votes, but they liked it.
John, just to finish up, though, where was the passion? And sometimes that passion in politics goes negative.
All of these candidates have seen the price you pay for going negative. Coming out of Iowa, the two top folks were just sort of scrambled and rolled down a hill into a ditch. That's Dean and Gephardt. They're not going to go negative. In fact, if there was any winner last night, I actually would say it was the Democratic Party, because there was enough of a core of commonly held beliefs that was relatively well articulated that it actually helps move the party along as it tries to define itself in a persuasive way as a contrast to the Republicans.
John Greenberg is executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Well, the candidates' debate in New Hampshire was the first of three network television appearances for Howard Dean last night. The candidate and his wife, Judy, talked about family, marriage, and that war whoop with ABC's Diane Sawyer. Dean said he was sheepish but not apologetic about the scream he let out in Iowa on Monday. Sawyer said it might be the kind of thing that could ruin his candidacy.
You know what, Diane? It could, but there's nothing I can do about it. I did it, I own it, and now we got to get back to running for president.
But first, on to the second tried-and-true stop on the campaign repair trail, late-night TV, in this case the David Letterman Show, where Dean read the top 10 ways I can turn things around.
Number two.
Fire the staffer who suggested that we do this lousy top 10 list instead of actually campaigning.
That's right, and it's about time. And the number one way I, Howard Dean, can turn things around?
Oh, I don't know, maybe fewer crazy red-faced rants?
So, did people-powered Howard rechart his political course? It's one of the questions we're putting before our Friday editorial roundtable. Joining us on the line, Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Robin.
And Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hello, Randy.
Hello, Robin.
Guy, to you first. We just heard that Dean might have at least held ground last night in New Hampshire and maybe even gained some ground. What are people saying to you?
That's it. You know, they were all pretty good, but what people were looking at was Howard Dean because of his war whoop. He probably last night won back some of his previous supporters. I found that among my friends, anyway, they were kind of satisfied that he came across as the sober and articulate fellow that they had been supporting all along.
Well, Randy, out there in Arizona, I know I may be the only person in the world who did not think that Dean looked angry last Monday night during that war whoop, but I'm wondering, is there any possibility that that could maybe even become a positive, that it could be something that's turned around as, you know, showing, as he said, his spirit?
We're a college town here with lots of whoop-it-up college kids, and they're in the Dean camp. In fact, he's the only candidate who's appeared in Flagstaff so far. And I think it was in character, and I don't think it, frankly, is going to hurt him.
No, really, in the long run, because, boy, it's sure being used as weapons. It's all over, you know, right-wing talk radio. And, in fact, Guy Dean took a jab at the media last night. He said to Diane Sawyer that it's been hard, but it's the horse race that excites folks like you, trying to sort of deflect some of it to the media.
Well, I think he was right. And just in case he didn't make the point strongly enough, let me try. I don't understand why some people in the news media persist in mischaracterizing this war whoop. It was an awkward attempt at expressing enthusiasm for the contest to come, and it looked goofy, that's true. But this piranha-like reaction of some in the news media is really quite disgraceful. You know, the New York Times today, in a front-page story, calls it, quote, his emotional outburst after a disappointing third-place finish in Iowa's caucuses. That sounds like he was angry. He wasn't angry.
Yeah, no,
trying to be a cheerleader.
Well, what else is going on here? I mean, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne wrote this week that Dean is last year's party message, that he gave the Democrats backbone, woke everyone up, but now his message has been co-opted by the other candidates. Do you agree, Randy?
No, I think actually Dean probably represents what a lot of people would like to say about the president and tax cuts and potentially the effect of the war on the budget, and they just haven't got around to it. He's out front. I think that is going to be the issue during the campaign, no matter who the nominee is.
I think I read a column in Newsday this morning that says that Dean may be an angry guy, but he's the angry guy I see when I look in the mirror. He's an angry, patriotic American guy. I think that really summed up his appeal.
Well, and here we are talking about him again, probably to the dismay of the other camps. I'm reminded that the last time a governor running for president had to defend himself with his wife by his side during the New Hampshire primary, he went on to be president. That, of course, Bill Clinton. And
he had a lot more to defend, let me say, than maybe making an inappropriate war whoop from a stage.
But, of course, you know, people are wondering now. An outcome may be probable, but it's never inevitable, as you learn in New Hampshire, Guy. And people are saying, is it going to be a Muskie Dukakis moment?
You know, let me tell you something. It is now Friday. And I bet you that at least half of the voters in New Hampshire haven't yet made up their minds who they're going to vote for on Tuesday. They've got an inkling, but they're going to go right up to Tuesday morning. There's no way to predict this.
And, of course, we look ahead to Arizona, where you are, Randy.
We're kind of jealous about all the stops by the candidates. We're still waiting for them to come. I do think that the parallels to the Bill and Hillary interview back in 92 are worth noting. I mean, the Deans came off as very warm and personable last night. I think that helps him here in Flagstaff and the state of Arizona, which has older couples who identify with that kind of marriage values. He said family is the most important thing to him, and that's an important message here.
Well, let's talk a little more about that. You know, we just heard it called Zip. Dean has said the Democratic Party needs its intensity to win against George Bush. I'm not sure if it was the flu they seemed to have, but all of the candidates seemed less intense last night. And Kerry has been criticized for being too aloof. Guy, your thoughts on whatever you call it, intensity, the personality, and some would say that also translates into electability.
Well, Kerry has learned something from Dean, and that is to refine your arguments down to simple declarative sentences with subjects and verbs that match, not like a congressional speech, but more like a conversation. He's doing better at it, and I thought last night he, but all of them really, did quite well. I agree with what we heard earlier in the program here, that he really did well, but so did the other candidates. So it was a good night for the Democrats.
And, Guy, you know, we are talking about things that are sort of amorphous, but what just name one issue that you are hearing more than others maybe in New Hampshire. When I was up there, it was the outsourcing of jobs. What are you hearing?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the environment and this MTBE gasoline additive that doesn't seem to resonate around the rest of the country. This may be the year of MTBE. The candidates are hearing a lot about it. And it came up again yesterday in the contest, I think.
And, Randy, when we get to Arizona, we'll ask you. One last quick question of you, though, Randy. Dean's wife, as we said, sat next to him last night. What are people saying in Arizona about her? And what impact does she have?
Well, she's obviously articulate. I think she's also committed to a career, and there are young voters, I think, who can identify with that.
You know, I was struck by the real lack of obvious phoniness in that interview. They seemed really sincere, and they even said some things that were a little self-deprecating, but I thought it was a very good interview and that they both did very well.
I want to thank you both.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire.
Just ahead, maybe good news on the Mars rover. New spunk in the spirit.
And later, candidate Wesley Clark.
More coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It looks like there might be life in the spirit after all. The rover isn't over. 2 days after it unexpectedly stopped communicating with Earth, NASA engineers say the Spirit Mars rover has started transmitting a limited amount of data. Scientists say the new communications will allow them to assess Spirit's health and start fixing any problems. All of this as the second American Mars rover, the Opportunity, prepares to land on the red planet tomorrow. Kelly Beatty is a planetary specialist and editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. He joins us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Kelly, welcome.
Hi. Good afternoon.
And first to the Spirit. What is happening?
The spacecraft is letting its handlers back on Earth know that it is alive and it can hear them and it will respond. Right now it's going through a series of health checks, which have been continuing all morning. The good news came while most of us were asleep this past morning, and the engineers haven't said much, but they have let us know that the spacecraft is not dead anyway.
Well, and it's been sort of a call-and-response kind of thing. They try to call to it and get it to respond in an intelligible way, if you will.
That's right. What was happening initially was that they were getting gibberish from it, which meant that it was still transmitting, but its computer was, you know, AWOL or something. And now that computer has been at least patched itself up to the extent that it knows that it's being communicated with and is starting to send back the information that will allow the engineers to fix it, if it can be fixed.
Well, there was great concern for a while that it might have gone the way of the Beagle, the British rover that's lost up there on Mars.
That's an interesting comparison. One of the things that happened to NASA in 1997 is they lost two spacecraft, and in part the tragedy was that they had no information from those spacecraft to let them know what was going wrong, and that's what happened to Beagle. It had no way of communicating as it was landing. One of NASA's fixes in bulking up its Mars spacecraft was to make sure that it had fail-safes like this in place so that the spacecraft was always able to transmit in some way, somehow, to get news back to Earth of its status.
Hmm. And so now you said that, you know, the hope is that it can continue its mission. What has it done already, and what is the rest of its mission?
Well, what it's done already is take a couple of analyses of the soil around it. It's all about the water, Robin. Both of these missions, Spirit and Opportunity, and to a larger extent Beagle 2 and its parent craft, Mars Express, it's quite crowded up there right now, are looking for signs on Mars that there is or was liquid water on the surface. As we know life, it requires this liquid water, and so it's an important step in proving or disproving that there was ever life on Mars.
Right. And as we know, it's taken the soil samples and it's taken the photographs. I just want to touch on that quickly before we move on. Some of them are just these breathtaking panoramic views, but also it's able to also take microscopic pictures.
Right, different cameras doing different tasks. The breathtaking panoramic views are simply reflecting the increasingly sophisticated technology that we're sending to the planet, and the ability for the spacecraft to send us back these remarkable, just, you know, you could be there kind of pictures. The microscopic imager is letting the geologists see in a very up-close way the mineral and crystal structure of the rocks that they're analyzing. We know a lot in general about the rocks on Mars, but it's the specifics that will tell us their history, and that's what we're after on this mission.
And there was other news from Mars today, in addition to the fact that the Spirit lives, and that is that there was some evidence of water, although NASA seems to be downplaying this ice that was found. Tell us about that.
Well, the big question on Mars is, we know it's had water on the past because we see rivers cut into its surface. We see polar caps that we know are made of ice. And where has all the water gone? The bet now is that it's buried beneath the surface, sort of subsurface glaciers or permafrost. And we want to know where those are on the planet. The European spacecraft called Mars Express has found water vapor in the atmosphere directly over where these deposits might lie. And I'm a little puzzled because that in and of itself is not news. A NASA spacecraft called Vikings discovered this, you know, during the mid-1970s. So in a sense, it's an exciting confirmation that there is water there. What will happen a little later this spring in April is this Mars Express European spacecraft has a radar on board that will probe into the surface and tell us where the deposits are actually lying and how deep they are.
Okay. Well, we mentioned also that Opportunity is supposed to land tomorrow. By the way, is Opportunity dependent on Spirit?
No, they're like clones of one another, and each operates independently. I think people may be in for a pleasant surprise if Opportunity lands. Its locale, where it's headed, will be likely a much different place than what we're seeing from Spirit right now.
Well, what it is dependent on, though, is funding. We just have a little over a minute left, Kelly, but as you know, Mars was much ado a couple weeks ago. There was the president had a proposed space plan, but he made no mention of it in his State of the Union speech this week, to the surprise of many. And there's been harsh criticism of the money that was going to be spent, most famously in a Wall Street Journal editorial. Someone like you, how would you justify this money that's being bandied about to perhaps travel to Mars?
Well, let me spin this a different way. I think this was something that Bush had to do in the wake of loss of Columbia last year, this time last year. People at that time were clamoring for the fact that if we're going to put astronauts at risk, let's at least have them do something worthwhile. And so Bush has dutifully put forward a plan that would have astronauts do something worthwhile. Is the timing right to launch a mission to Mars? Or to the moon? In the absence of a bad economic climate and record budget deficits, it might well be. But I think it's going to be a really hard sell in Congress, frankly.
Yeah. And were you surprised that after all the to-do a couple weeks ago, there was absolutely no mention of it in the State of the Union?
I think what NASA officials are saying is wait until the budget comes out. The budget will speak for itself. But I do think that it's a sign that maybe Bush's heart really isn't in it if it wasn't part of his State of the Union.
Yeah. And then immediately afterward, poor Spirit went silent.
That's right.
Kelly, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Kelly Beatty is editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. He spoke to us from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Next week on Here and Now, all eyes on New Hampshire. We'll check in with voters on the eve of the primary there.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, we talk to candidate General Wesley Clark on whether or not President Bush was a military deserter.
I have no idea whether President Bush was or not. I don't have any access to any of the facts on this matter, and frankly, I'm not interested in it.
And in the new film, The Butterfly Effect, Ashton Kutcher changes more than his past.
Your accents change. You don't even walk the same.
Well, I walk differently.
I mean, that dinner tonight, it was so beautiful. It was gorgeous. But it just wasn't you.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Nearly a dozen people have been killed in Iraq during the past 2 days in an apparent upsurge in attacks. The latest victims are two men who were killed in an explosion at the Baghdad office of the Iraqi Communist Party. A party official says a bomb may have been planted in their meeting hall. Also, two Iraqi police officers were killed when gunmen fired on a police checkpoint west of the capital. In what is being called the first solid indication of corruption involving U.S.-funded projects in Iraq, Halliburton, the oil services company tied to Vice President Dick Cheney, admits that two employees took up to $6 million in kickbacks. Halliburton reportedly has fired the employees. They're accused of accepting kickbacks for awarding a Kuwaiti-based company with work supplying U.S. troops in Iraq. There are new signs of hope for NASA's Mars rover. Scientists say the rover sent back some limited data today in response to a command from Earth. It had stopped transmitting meaningful data for 2 years. NASA is planning more opportunities to talk to the rover today. Meanwhile, the European Space Agency says Mars Express has detected evidence of water on the planet's south pole.
I think we can firmly say, yes, there was water acting on the surface of Mars. And quite a number of the features we've seen originate from the action of water on the surface.
American scientists are downplaying the discovery, saying it's old news, that it simply supports previous data. The Democratic presidential candidates are on the campaign trail with just days to go before Tuesday's crucial New Hampshire primary. Tracking polls show Senator John Kerry widening his lead. In last night's debate, Kerry said he would need the backing of the American people before going to war.
I will never conduct a war or start a war because we want to. The United States of America should only go to war because we have to. And if you live by that guidance, you'll never have veterans throwing away their medals or standing up in protest.
The debate was sponsored by WMUR-TV, Fox News Channel, ABC News, and the Union Leader. The Illinois death row inmates whose sentences were commuted by the governor last year have won a victory in the state's highest court. The Illinois Supreme Court says former Governor George Ryan had the power to commute the sentences of everyone on death row before he left office last year. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow was up. The NASDAQ and S&P are down.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
We spoke this morning with candidate General Wesley Clark. I began by asking him about his reaction to filmmaker Michael Moore's accusation that President George Bush was a deserter when he was in the Texas National Guard in 1972 and 1973. General Clark stood right beside Moore as he made the charge at a Clark rally, and General Clark has never repudiated the comment, including at last night's New Hampshire debate. So I asked General Clark whether he believes President George was a deserter.
I have no idea whether President Bush was or not.
Well, General Clark,
every person in this country has a right to say what they want. And I fought to defend that right. And I defend his right to say whatever he believes.
But General Clark, as you
necessarily agree with it or disagree with it. I don't have any access to any of the facts on this matter. And frankly, I'm not interested in it. This election is about the future.
General, just to stay with it for one moment. AWOL is defined in the Universal Code of Military Justice, as you no doubt know, as being absent for 30 days or less. Desertion as being absent for 30 days or more with no intention of returning. Lieutenant Bush in 1973, from 1972 to 1973, was gone for a year, one of his officers said. I've seen it in writing. What do you make of that?
I'm focused on the future. This election is about the future. And what I want to talk about are the issues that are important for this country. We've got a success strategy to get us out of the mess in Iraq. I'll work hard to bring peace in the Middle East and keep this country safe from terrorism. And we're going to help families in this country. Those are the issues. I'm delighted to have Michael Moore's support. I think Michael Moore's a man of conscience. He's a man who's done a lot for working Americans. And he represents a lot of people in this country. And I'm glad I've got him with me.
General, two decorated and courageous military officers trying to win the New Hampshire primary, you and Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts. What would you say to a voter trying to make up their mind between the two of you?
Well, I'd say you have to look at, you know, whose experience better prepares him to be president.
Senator Kerry's been in Washington.
Right. I haven't. I'm an outsider. I have worked in public service almost my entire adult life. So my experience in the military was experience of leadership. I was creating organizations, building teams, setting goals, motivating, inspiring, and working those goals. The presidency is an office that's about acting and doing. It's not about talking and debating.
General Clark, as a Roman Catholic, what's your position on abortion?
I'm pro-choice.
Doesn't that contradict your Catholicism?
Well, you know, I have an individual conscience, and I just disagree with the Catholic Church on that point.
General Clark, on the budget, on the economy, you say you'd repeal tax cuts for families with incomes over $200,000. But that savings would be nowhere near the $2.35 trillion you say you can save over 10 years. Where would the money come from?
Tax cuts, you'll get more than $1 trillion over 10 years.
Right.
You'll pick up an additional $300 to $400 billion from corporate subsidies, another $150 billion from better control of Medicare and Medicaid expenses, another $100 or more billion from government efficiencies, and about $600 billion from interest rate savings. There may be one or two items more on my website in there, but that's the plan, savings for America's future. It will bring us in $2 1/3 trillion.
General Wesley Clark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Democratic candidate General Wesley Clark. Now, as we've said earlier in the program, many in New Hampshire are still trying to make up their minds who their candidate is. Jan Rasico of Ware is one. She's a military wife. Her late husband was in the Marine Reserves. And she's an independent. Jan likes President Bush, but she also prizes what can make the New Hampshire primary so unpredictable. The right to make up her mind once and for all, only when she's good and ready. Yesterday, we spoke with Jan Rasico at the Mall of New Hampshire in Manchester. Now, Jan, you are sitting with me here in that most of American of places, a shopping mall, and you come from perhaps that most American of families, a military family. How are you feeling at this point about the war in Iraq?
I think strides have been made. We may not know all of the strides that have been made, but I do believe positive things have come out of it, and I think that we need to press on until the job is done.
Tell me your story, your husband, your family.
My husband, Dale, was 54 years old. He was deployed to Kuwait, actually last January. And he came home in August, actually, it was August 8th, and 3 hours later, my husband had a massive heart attack and he passed away. A lot of people think that that's just a really cruel joke that was played on our family. We don't look at it that way at all. We feel that we were really blessed that he was able to come home and we got to see him. There were over 500 families who didn't get to see their loved ones before they died over there. So I don't look at it as a negative thing.
It's courageous of you to say that you can find a blessing in what happened, in that your husband was with you. And you mentioned 500 American families haven't had that. They lost their sons or daughters in this war. What do you think those 500 died for?
Those people had a constitution many, many years ago. And in came Saddam Hussein, and he completely overthrew and took away every single one of their rights. People in the world need to be free. How wonderful it is that we are free. Why shouldn't anyone else in the world have that same right?
And that's worth the ultimate sacrifice of a young American's life. Such sacrifices are worth it.
I think that sacrifices like that have been made since the beginning of time.
So, Jan, Tuesday is the primary. Mm-hmm. What's your political persuasion?
Well, I consider myself an independent. I prefer to vote for the person rather than the party. But I'm very much undecided at this point.
You remain very steadfast in very much the mentality that President Bush brings to the issue, which is that, look, we liberated a people, and an evil man is out of the picture. Why aren't you just clear as a bell, a supporter of President Bush? You said, as an independent, you're open to all comers, but isn't President Bush pretty much expressing very much the way you feel about all this?
Yes, absolutely. And I do support President Bush 100%. Do I have the right to vote right now? Yeah, I do. But like I said before, I'm very undecided. But for right now, if you were to say to me, I very candidly tell you, yeah, I'll be voting for President Bush.
But you keep a part of yourself in reserve, an independence in yourself. Your mind still could be changed.
That's possible.
Jan Rasico, an independent voter from Ware, New Hampshire.
Still to come, chaos theory and the film The Butterfly Effect.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's despicable, unspeakable, and almost commonplace. According to a cover story in the upcoming New York Times Sunday magazine, thousands of girls and boys, some under the age of 12, are bought, traded, and horribly abused in a sex slave industry in America. And reporter Peter Landesman says the U.S. has become a major importer of sex slaves, perhaps as many as 10,000 a year. He joins us on the line. And Peter, we've heard that this occurs in the U.S., but the magnitude is overwhelming. Where are these children? Where are they being forced into slavery?
I actually need to say first that if 10,000 a year disturbs you, the probable real number, for a number of reasons, that number is very conservative and political, but the probable real number is probably in the six figures. We're probably talking 100 to 200,000 girls, women, imported into the United States per year from mostly the countries of the former Soviet Union and Mexico, also Southeast Asia, but mostly they come through Mexico.
But that sounds impossible. I mean, people would be saying, but I'd know that. If there was a house on my street with 10 girls in it being forced to service, 10 little girls being forced to service grown men, I would notice that.
You have to understand there are a number of subsets in this industry. The toddler enterprise is probably done a little more under the radar. But these kids are kept in basements in upper and middle class neighborhoods. Traffickers do that specifically because it's the last place police and neighbors and neighborhoods would bother to look.
Mm. And you quote a U.S. State Department official as saying, we're not finding these children in the United States because we're not looking for them.
We don't know how to look for them. We don't know what they look like. For instance, just take a very youthful, prostitute prowling the streets in Los Angeles or New York. Police usually ignore them because in most states they're misdemeanors. Sometimes they just look at them as workaday paperwork.
Or undocumented workers.
Yeah, or they're undocumented. But the point is that many of these girls are actually in literal and figurative chains. Mm-hmm. Many of them are actually slaves. If they tried to escape, they and or their families back home in their villages would be killed.
And many of them thought they were going to nanny jobs, waitressing jobs, and went happily.
Yeah, one of the most cynical aspects of this, in the former Soviet Union, babysitting and nanny and waitress jobs are advertised in sunny L.A. in countries like Moldova and the Ukraine. And these girls think they're heading into, you know, waving palm trees in the sun. They arrive in Mexico City on their way to the United States, and once in Mexico, they're in captivity and trained in a sort of barbaric method before they're shipped across the border.
But, Peter, you met with officials from immigration, police, social workers. You, for instance, showed some immigration officials websites, and it stunned them where you showed them websites where these girls were being bought and traded. You went to a place carved out in a riverbed where in the reeds little rooms had been carved out so that men could use these children. If you as a reporter can find it, you know, why can't officials?
The problem is that local law enforcement doesn't know what this looks like, and the federal government really has no clue this is even going on. They're just beginning to tap the reality. But I have to say that when I brought what I knew and learned to law enforcement and to Washington and to the federal government, most of them were astonished. They'd never even heard of this. Mm. And to this day, most of them don't even acknowledge it happens.
Well, Peter, I wish we had more time, and we will revisit this topic, but I don't suppose I'd ever look at a young child maybe on a street corner or at a gas station the same way again.
Indeed. After reporting the story for 4 months, I feel as though I see a whole other population of human beings walking the planet.
Well, Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Peter Landesman's article, The Girls Next Door, appears in this week's issue of the Sunday New York Times Magazine.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The film The Butterfly Effect opens nationwide today. Robin will speak with our film reviewer Renee Graham about that in just a few minutes. But first, we thought we'd ask, what is the butterfly effect? Stephen Strogatz is a professor of applied mathematics at Cornell University. His latest book is called Sync, The Emerging Science of Spontaneous Order. Stephen joins us on the line. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. What is the butterfly effect?
Well, the butterfly effect is something we're all familiar with in everyday life. It's the idea that little things can sometimes have a big impact, and so the term comes from the the kind of silly folklore that a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil could change the weather in Texas, causing a tornado. No one's ever caught that butterfly, but so it's something we can all believe in, that you can imagine times thinking in your own life where if you just not gotten on that bus, maybe you wouldn't have met the woman who became your wife or whatever. You can look at little things that would, your whole life would be different if they didn't happen.
Now, is there a link between chaos theory and the butterfly effect?
Yeah, you might even call chaos theory the science of the butterfly effect. They're almost the same thing.
In what sense?
Well, chaos theory is an attempt to use the methods of math and science and engineering to come to grips with how it could be that that tiny changes could sometimes have an enormous impact, and to figure out which systems are prone to that kind of sensitivity and which are immune to it.
Isn't there something inherently contradictory about applying mathematics to something that has to do with chaos, which by its very nature, chaos, doesn't behave mathematically, right?
Well, that's a nice question. And, of course, math is so powerful. We apply it to just about anything that a human being can think of or observe. So, after all, there is probability theory, which lets you study things that are inherently unpredictable, like life expectancy or, you know, car crashes. So there's the traditional theory of probability, which is about totally random systems. Chaos takes that one step further by thinking about things that look unpredictable, but finding, at least in certain cases, hidden patterns. That's the optimistic side of chaos theory, is that things that we used to think were hopelessly unpredictable might actually have secret laws governing them, and in the case that we can discover those, we might actually begin to get a measure of understanding of them.
And give me one brief example of what you mean.
Well, it's been hoped that the stock market, of course, is not just random, but maybe has hidden rules, and there are people out there, you know, spending a lot of money trying to figure out what those rules might be by studying lots of data. And if they're in there, you could be sure that there'd be a lot of money to be made. But I kind of doubt it. The one important caveat about all this is that the actual science of chaos, as it's developed, really only works well for systems with just very few variables. But once you start applying it to things like human behavior or the stock market or a big ecosystem with hundreds of species, the truth is it's beyond what we understand today, and our math starts to fall apart there.
So, Stephen, just to finish up where we started, the butterfly effect, is it conceivable that if you could bring all the powers of observation to bear on a butterfly fluttering its wings, that how it stirs the air could impact something on the other side of
the
globe?
It could, but it would be impossible to trace that back to that butterfly, because there were butterflies all over the globe doing the same thing. And, you know, that's why it's such a silly metaphor in a way. But in principle, any one of them, if its behavior were changed, could have an enormous impact. It's possible.
Stephen Strogatz is a professor of applied mathematics at Cornell University. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Thanks, Bill.
Now that we've heard about the theory, on to the film, The Butterfly Effect, wherein Ashton Kutcher, best known for his TV comedy work and his relationship with the older actress Demi Moore, takes a dramatic turn as Evan, a college psychology student, who discovers that his childhood diaries, which chronicle his troubled past, have the power to take him back there.
Read me something.
It's like my mind refuses to believe what I'm seeing. Just writing about it gives me the shivers.
Come on.
It was like Tommy was possessed or something. There was a hate in his eyes that...
Well, to find out the effect of the butterfly effect on the audience, we welcome here now film reviewer Renee Graham. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
As we said, this is a departure for Ashton, who I can't help it. When you stand in the supermarket, there he is everywhere because of his relationship.
Demi Moore's boy toy. makes his big dramatic turn.
Well, okay, that kind of signals us. I've heard that you're not a big fan.
I'm not.
Because what? Why?
You know, he's done that 70s show for a while, which is fine for what it is. And he's done fairly dumb comedies like Just Married and Dude, Where's My Car? I just think he's pretty to look at, but I think he's really a lightweight. Mm-hmm. However, I give him credit for attempting to stretch.
Yeah, and did he make the stretch?
He's not terrible. he's not distracting, I would say it that way as well. He plays this young man, Evan, who realizes that by reading his childhood diaries that he can alter events in his past. But what he comes to realize over the course of the film is that when he does that, he also changes the future. And what we see really early on is how it not only affects his life, but affects the lives of his friends and family, in particular a young girl, Kaylee, who he grows up with. And early in the movie, we see, because of a change that he made, just how unhappy she winds up being.
Who are you trying to convince? What do you want me to just cry on your shoulder and tell you everything's all better now? Nothing's all better, okay? Nothing ever gets better.
as we hear in that clip, you know, it's caused all this chaos, and that causes him to want to continually go back and try to change things to make her life better. But when he makes her life better, he then throws someone else's life out of whack, and that's how the film sort of rolls along.
It sounds like the butterfly effect. It sounds like a combination of It's a Wonderful Life, you know, going back to see your life, and The Sorcerer's Apprentice from Fantasia, where the brooms keep cutting. And
I mean, there's a bit of that. I mean, and the film just has this really evergreen premise. You know, we all want to go back and change things we did in our past to somehow alter the way we are now. But what the movie, I think, does fairly well is to show that even a slight change can throw everything else off. And the changes don't always happen to him. They can happen to Kaylee. They happen to his mother. They happen to his friends. And he has to, it's almost like he's trying to unlock the proper combination so that everyone's lives end up sort of happy and settled. What's interesting in the film, though, and I think a little less so with his character, are the characters who are around him, especially the actress Amy Smart, who plays Kaylee, because depending on the outcome of what happens to her as a child, you know, in the movie we see her go from being this bitter, dead-end, you know, waitress in some greasy spoon to being a frothy sorority girl in a different scenario, and to the most shocking of all, being this scarred crack whore.
So, how's Trix?
Sorry. Occupational humor.
I got it. You stop now.
Oh, sorry. Is my line of work making you uncomfortable, Precious?
No. Just that you felt like you had to use it to hurt me.
Who else is in the film?
Eric Stoltz is in the film, playing a rather unpleasant character. I want to mention Ethan Suplee, who plays Thumper, who is Ashton Kutcher's college roommate, and he's just like this big, bruising, sex-crazed goth guy. You kind of have to see it to appreciate it. It's a very funny and interesting performance. It's not really a hard movie to keep up with, given how much time travel you have, but it probably goes on a little longer than it needs to go on. Mm-hmm.
You know, it also is making me think of the film Frequency, where the character went back in time through an old radio, and audiences loved that film, and they went along with the premise. So I'm wondering, do you think audiences will, you know, suspend disbelief for Butterfly Effect?
I think they might. I mean, because what the film has on its side is that everyone in that audience will think back to something in their past they wish they could have changed. So even if you aren't necessarily gripped by the film itself, the idea of being able to do that's really interesting. But also the idea that, you know, you can make something better in the past, but make things much, much worse in the future.
Hmm. Renee, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here now, film reviewer Renee Graham. We've been talking about The Butterfly Effect, which opens in theaters today.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Brad Fritz, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild's our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette and Boris Trapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
All eyes are on New Hampshire. We'll check in with voters on the eve of the primary.
And we'll look at how the Bush White House is positioning their man for re-election.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.